Inspiring. Talking about Kafka is always like a mixed bag because I always get like really motivated. It always generates like a lot of intellectual activity, makes me want to write, makes me want to do some things, but also there's like a second edge to it that's like, ow.
Yeah.
Couldn't I have just like gone for a hike?
Yeah, there's something, I've always thought there's something kind of dangerous about reading certain writers, that like you can kind of acquire the mind of an author if you do the deep dive.
Yeah.
And like sometimes I've lamented in my life, like I got really into Herman Melville, was my sort of first love. And like that was maybe a bad choice. Like if in terms of like the quality of my life psychologically,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can take some, you can definitely take some psychic damage. And you know, The thing is, people will think that you get that from something that's just like I don't know, horrifying in like an overt way. And that is not the case for me. It's that more of that like Kafka does it more to me than Blood Meridian, say.
Yeah.
You know, it's makes it a little, you just think you're going to wake up, be a bug one day, you know?
Right.
And then maybe some days you are. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that so, the bug man met, or a meme.
Really, yeah, came around, right?
Was the punctuation for Kafka, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. You will be in a bug. You will live in a pod. You will be a bug. Well, the good thing about that is at least there is something beautiful about like the whole bug man meme, and partially because it was sort of true, right? Like if you go back and you read whoever wrote that first essay about the bug men, was that Yarvin maybe? I don't remember.
I don't know, actually. Yeah.
But if you go back to that, the value of that was that like, it was like, okay, so I should at least try to not do the bug man stuff too much. And maybe I can like just somehow avoid it by not overdoing it. Not that the person who wrote that essay has the answer by any means, but like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't play video games that much, or whatever, you know, whatever your predilection happens to be. I had to quit video games like they were heroin about 15 years
me
ago.
Too. I think I made it to like age 32 or so before I stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, what the fuck am I doing?
I'm done. Yeah. Yeah. This is over.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
never mind porn. Like let's talk about that.
A real extended psyop.
It sure is.
Gets real dark.
It certainly can, man. And the video game thing was, to me, it's almost worse because, well, I guess it depends on how your brain works, man, because the video game thing for me was like, I'll just play until 4 o'clock in the morning. I have to work the next day. I'll just deal with that tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to get that gold star on.
Or whatever. Yeah, some bullshit. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. One thing we said we were going to talk about on this After Dark, because we said we were going to talk about sort of contemporary literature, what is happening right now. There's interesting things happening, I think. I think there's sad things happening. The online discourse is kind of insane about it. I don't know. Like, what is... Casey, is there anything you've read like that has been come out in the last few? I kind of go to you for sort of older stuff, to be honest.
Yeah.
But is there anything happening now that even in the last 20 years, say, that you think is interesting, exciting, holds up maybe to somebody like a Melville? I don't know that anybody holds up to Melville, but.
Yeah. I do think, let me just start with a name that some people won't know, which is a Russian writer named Viktor Pelevin, who I was thinking about like who I should mention on your show. And this is a guy who is, I think, still younger than 60. I started reading him in the early 2000s. And I would recommend starting with a book that's, I think, called Homo Sapiens with a Z. And it's, I mean, this guy is like basically one of the first post-Soviet writers. So like part of what he's trying to sort out is, you know, what is Russia now, you know, starting in like 1993 or so. And, so he's definitely got that like kind of, I hate to use the terminology, but like postmodernist mindset, which is to say, like, to him, it's kind of all a joke. There's certainly an Illuminati, but who cares? You know, like, yeah. We're going to do mushrooms and see visions of Che Guevara and, like,
fair enough.
You know, yeah, like, there's, stuff
there's,
like that.
Yeah. Hail so, Satan. There's no.
Yeah. So, like, I really
think that's real.
One of his books is actually yeah. set in, I want to say, Ukraine, and there's like a fake war between Ukraine and Russia. This was written in like 2014. Like, it's kind of astonishing. And he talks about how everything's going to be like, what do you call it? Like holograms, you know, and deep fakes basically. And stuff.
Interesting. Okay.
So, yeah. He's really like, that's a guy who I think is sort of doing, you know, vital writing right now.
Interesting. Very cool. Yeah.
I mean, I will say I'm kind of looking forward to Cormac McCarthy's two books this fall, but like, you know, with bait or held breath, because I mean, he is 88. Like, I don't know if he's going to be able to pull it off, but
I think he's going full Gnostic, full.
That would be
hard
really,
Gnostic.
That would be the best possible way to go out.
I think he is. He's been teasing us for my entire life. So I think it's going to actually fully flower. Yeah.
It would be awesome just to see. I mean,
no, I am the audience for Cormac.
Are you Kevin?
Yes.
Yes. I am. Just I thought
me.
I was.
Just me. Yeah. Just me.
Our friend Aaron Gwynn has already read those books.
Christ.
Oh, really? Are you serious?
He's in the publishing world, and he's got advanced reader copies. So he's already read them. And
just the
I've
book.
Been, like having both things
Nobody's
like, wanting to talk to him about
for
it.
Me.
And also not wanting to talk to him about it at all.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah. No. The other thing I would say in my reading, like I'm probably most familiar with contemporary poetry, actually.
So yeah, what's going on there? Because I don't read any contemporary poetry.
Well, I was going to say, like, up through about 2012 is where I kind of started to check out, because in part that's really when, like, the journals and publishers kind of went woke. And to be honest, it really has been. I think I can just say abstractly, my wife really is still writing, really is still publishing, but in terms of like publishing the book or whatever, she's getting letters back from editors that just explicitly say, like, we're kind of looking to do more marginalized voices
and
you know, yours isn't it.
So,
but I think there probably are a lot of writers like her that are still, you know, primarily dealing with just like images that conjure feelings, you know, whatever that thing that Wordsworth said in Spontaneity.
Since I've started being active on Twitter in the last couple of years, I've started to make friends with people whose work I've read that I really like. And I think there's an interesting thing where, like, there is something going on in the small print space that it's a little bit, I don't know. It's almost, you want to say it's like the opposite. It's against all that woke stuff. It's not even that. It's just that it's not necessarily playing in that game.
Yeah. It just didn't take the hard turn, I think.
And so there's like a lot of that going on. Kevin and I kind of experienced, Kevin and I both graduated. We were in MFA program together. We both graduated in 2010.
Yeah.
And it spiraled. It was spiraling. It was gradually spiraling into wokeness. And then, like, now you see kind of the output from it, and it's like, wow. Like,
it's kind of, like, amazing. Yeah.
Like, there is an example. There was a woman there who, great writer. She was my advisor. You know, she's in her 50s probably, and she's written, I'm not going to say who she is, but she's written some great books that are out there. She was sort of next in line to take the program over, to run the program. The guy ran it, was aged out. He was in his 80s. Wonderful man. And then, sort of as it became obvious that she was going to take over, there was a protest that she wasn't marginalized enough.
Satanism.
And it
they're
was, a, it was
like,
a,
they're
she was,
satanic.
She was a white, she was a white woman. And it was like, that wasn't enough somehow. Like,
She needs to be, she needs to be like some sort of a queer.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I mean, I know that you guys know this, and I know it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it does suck that we're three white guys.
Sucks.
Going, like, what's wrong with all these minorities taking our publishing positions or whatever?
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, that there's never, that's not really ever been, like, if your chief concern is who wrote it, in some sense, like, you're missing the point, right?
Right.
I mean, or at least that's what I've kind of always believed.
That's what I always thought. Yeah.
Like, I know you can, like, I do think, and you know, your show is an example of this. Like, it's often interesting to read the biography of a person as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing is, like, if you do it carefully and like with generous mind, almost anyone's biography is super interesting.
Yes.
Like, you know, especially if they're writing interesting stuff. So
I don't know.
I don't know about these preferences for one type over.
Yeah. Another. That's what's so weird. Well, that was the thing that was kind of, it was just like, that to me was like, I was at, up until then, I was sort of like, okay, like I'm willing to admit that we haven't been meritocratic in the past. And maybe we have been a little, there's been favoritism towards the demographic I happen to be in. I was willing to admit, see that and look for it. But then like when that happened, I was like, but you're not like, how much does it have to be? And like, where does it, is there ever a time where you don't put, and then it just kind of spiraled and got worse from there. So
yeah,
it's been,
but as a reader, it's frustrating too, because you know that there are like some just undiscovered gems out there, and it's just someone needs to just show them to me. I will say that, like, I'll give you a string of names here that were the kind of poets that I was reading up to about 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I really liked Mark Strand. Bridget Pagene Kelly wrote good poetry.
Bridget Pagene is. Yeah. She taught for a semester at our program, and I loved her. Like.
It's amazing.
I love her as a person.
Truly amazing.
Yeah, she passed away a few years ago, which was tragic.
But there's a poet called Mary Leader who I think is still living, but writes very, like, these are poets who, in some cases, I mean, it's they sort of each have their own individual style, and you just have to sort of find one that you like. But like for me, these are poets that were either, like, in the case of Mark Strand, he seems almost Kafkaesque to me at times. Like, he writes sometimes these little prose poems that are just sort of half a page or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they end on that like sort of unclosed note where you're kind of like, well, that can't be the end. He'll intentionally deny you the catharsis.
Right.
And there's something kind of artful about doing that self-consciously, you know? Yeah.
Well, that's a fact of life. Maybe it always has been, but it certainly feels like one now.
For me, anyway. Yeah. And that Mary Leader poet writes sometimes in less, like, very not narrative way, but almost wholly lyrical, where she's experimenting with like sound and form and sort of interesting things like that. Like, I've always been kind of interested in genre shifting moves in literature. So like a lot of times, you know, people will recommend to me novels and I'm like, well, if it's just like a novel, I mean I've read lots of novels, like, but is it gonna be weird to me where I'm gonna go like, hold on,
you
know? Like, I think I actually really loved, I think it was your fourth chapter, right, in House of Sleep.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that the right one where, like, it's,
I don't know what chapter it is.
Well, it's like all of a sudden we're dealing with this kid with the dad that's, you know, and you almost, for me at least, it's like, wait a minute. Like, I thought I was reading a book, but now I'm in another dimension, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fun.
Well, I'm definitely the same way. It's like, you know, there is an element of like, I'm only going to get to read so many books. I've got all these old books that I know that I want to get to. If it's going to be something new, you know, it's got to kind of punch me in the face a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, there's got to be something in there that,
yeah,
like, something in there's got to get me off.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we only have so much time. Like, that's a real concern after, you know, of a certain age. Like, I think, you know, I think people have to learn to read on sort of whatever, like, because you got to learn to like it. And so, you know, like, my daughter's reading, I don't know, like, Hunger Games right now, and I want her to be reading Henry David Thoreau, but, like, you know, I'll take it. But then, like, you know, I do think, like, for me, I'm to the point in life where I figure, like, I might have 300 or 400 more books that I'm going to read, and it's like that the list has to be carefully curated at this point, you know.
Right.
I just read Don DeLillo's book White Noise for the first time, actually.
Oh, really? Oh,
and cool. I was kind of like, it was okay. you know?
Yeah, okay.
Which is like pretty, like that's saying a lot because people love that book.
Yeah.
And it's cool if you guys love it. But like for me, I was like, yeah, okay.
Fair enough.
I do like the nuns at the end were pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, there's something about that, you know, I haven't read that book in a while. There are certain books that they have such a profound influence mm-hmm. that when you go back to them, it's sort of like, yeah, what's the big, because like everything since then was sort
point.
Of tinged by it. And I think White Noise kind of was like that. White Noise had, you know, Infinite Jest is has been touched by White Noise and a bunch of books since then.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I think you can go back and it's sort of like going back to, it's going back to like listening to Bill Hicks or who is the comedian, the Jewish comedian in the 60s.
Yeah, those are great examples. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, where you go back and you're like, yeah, this isn't, I mean, it's good, but right. but at the time it was like, what is he talking about? You know? Like,
yeah.
Now it's like, oh, well, everybody said that. So yeah, so there's an element of that.
Actually, that's like a perfect analogy, that analogy with the stand-up comics and like how hard it is to tell a joke that will still make people laugh in 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, almost impossible. Like, you know, you can read Twain and occasionally he'll hit, but like a lot of it, it's kind of like, okay, I get it. But
right.
But I think you're right.
Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, oh, that's
Lenny Bruce is who I was thinking. Like, that's just not that funny. But like, nothing but respect for the guy.
But it's like, you know, if you're
and if I would have been, it's not like if I would have been alive, then I would have been better than him or something. You know,
no, yeah.
But like, it just kind of doesn't quite land right.
Yeah,
and I think that's a challenge of trying to write now too. It's like there's a thing we've done where like, not that everything has been done because I don't think that's ever really the case. I mean, it's true in a sense, but like, we have this like. The wave of novelty has like crested and like there are no movements anymore. Everything is fair game. Like you can be in the visual arts, it's easier to conceptualize, but it's like you can be in the visual arts now and you can be doing like Art Nouveau stuff. You can be doing like, you know, wood carving. You can be doing any of it and any of it makes sense. There's really the trends are, you know, three people make a trend and they're all, it's also atomized that like, you can't even place yourself in in a way.
Part of it is like the schizophrenia, or that's not quite the right word, but of the of like what would be the reading audience. Mm-hmm. And so like you say, I mean, people are just kind of like you can find somebody to say like, wow, I really am into your driftwood art, you know, or whatever.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that you've tapped into the muses, you know, just because there's a couple of people who might like it. So part of, I mean, I think back actually to, you guys, I think are a little younger than I am. I'm 44.
Yeah, I'm 39.
So, you remember like that period when, when I started on Facebook or MySpace, people, and there was that little box that said music, like what music you like.
Yeah,
I think for me and my generation, at least, we kind of just like put up our music. It was like, I like Dave Matthews. Like, well, who cares, you know?
Right.
But then the kids behind me, it seemed like it became a marker of identity. So it was it became this like self-conscious, like you were performing when you put up your, the bands that you liked and they became more and more obscure to the point where like, I didn't understand who all these bands were. It was, you know, so everyone was listening to something else. Now we all have Spotify or Napster or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone's in their different direction. Whereas like, I think there was more of a coherent, like there was like a culture in Boston when people were reading Emerson, you know what I mean? Like they all kind of like were on the same page.
Yeah.
I know that sounds quaint, but I do think it's largely true.
I know for me growing up, it felt like there was a monoculture and then there was a counterculture and there were maybe like a few neighborhoods in the counterculture and that was kind of it. And now it's like it's extremely and I think there's cool things about that. I mean, you know, because everybody gets to self-select what they're into. So it's neat and it's fascinating and you can spend your whole life, you know, exposing yourself to all kinds of different, you know, artwork and ideas and all of that. But there is something. I mean, that's the thing that I feel like people are like, well, why is everything so divisive right now? Why is everything so divisive? It's because we're living in 330 million different realities.
Yeah.
Like, how would it not be the divisive, you know? We used to get just the information just blasted at all of us at the same time.
Do you imagine, like, Hawthorne used to write about his ideal reader? Like he has these interesting prefaces, like in the Marble Faun preface, which was his last book in like 1861 or two. He says something like, I wonder if this reader even still exists. Like, in other words, he has a very specific, he knows who he wants to be reading the book.
Right.
But he knows this person is kind of rare and maybe like either aged out or, you know, something like that. I mean, do you, who are you picturing reading your books, or do you not that?
I mean, I do a little bit. I really kind of try to subscribe to the Toni Morrison bit where it's like, I'm trying to write the book that I want to read. I mean, that sounds maybe a little boring or whatever, but that's kind of, that's the best I can do because, you know, there's a thing like in real life, like when I go out to hang out with some friends, none of those people read.
Right.
Nobody, my wife reads a bit.
I know.
Some of her friends read a little bit. Other than that, that's it. So like, I don't even know. Everybody I know who reads is like somebody like you that I know a little bit online.
From the computer.
From the computer. And as friendly as we can be and as good of a conversation, you're still a guy in the computer in a lot of ways. And so I have a hard time conceptualizing who that person could even be.
Yeah.
It's tricky.
I went like this, when Kevin comes back, we can ask him too. Cause I am interested in like theater. I mean, what do you, like,
oh, there he is. Yeah.
Who, it's like, who are these people? I mean, you know, cause theater seems like a very urban thing.
Oh man. Right?
It's not it's not actually North Dakota. It's more like you have to go, or, I mean, unless there's a city in North Dakota.
No, there's no.
But like, yeah, you, so it's city people that you have to kind of write for, which is a kind of constraint almost, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Correct. Of course. I mean, you know, so you're trying to, so the thing that we might do in the fall is Salt Mother, which is this new play where one audience member. No. Salt Mother.
it is the opposite of a sugar.
It's the opposite of a sugar daddy.
Yeah.
The Salt Mother, and then like they, you know, so it will be, we will do the play with six of us. And then that, like, the audience member will be the one participant, you know.
Oh, wait. So you will have one audience member?
Yes. And it will be like $20 or $30. And we will Salt Mother.
Wow.
That's
That's a genius idea.
That's
you should
pretty
make
cool.
More than that, though. Make it $500.
Yeah.
No.
It's because you're this close to like bringing back.
Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to do.
Yeah. But I have thought like we're this close to bringing back like actual patronage.
Yeah.
Or we just like find some rich guy and go, hey, I'll make a play for you.
Right. No. Right. Yeah. Right. Of course. I mean, yeah. You're gonna rediscover theater with me. No,
will it be different for each? Is there a way for it to kind of evolve for each? Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
The Salt Mother will not deliver the same speech each time. The Salt Mother will say something differently.
That's pretty cool.
My friend Amanda is going to be the Salt Mother.
That actually is exciting. I think that sounds really cool, man.
Yes.
Sorry.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah.
No, so it's going to be awesome.
That sounds rad. So there is interesting.
Hey, you know, theater is awful. I mean,
I like theater.
Hey. No, but it's going to be good. It's like, you know, we're going to be like five or six of us, and then we're all going to, you know, I'll probably like be outside trying to, we're a cult.
Yeah.
The
theater has a cult like aspect to it anyway, right? Your theater troupe, there is something cult like about that already. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You don't have to go very far for it to be an actual cult.
It's almost like it's supposed to be that. I guess I think of it that way.
Yeah.
So like maybe it was a mistake to turn it into this kind of institutional thing that's like uptown right next to the Bank of America or something.
Yeah. Well, one thing's for sure, putting art in the Academy was a mistake.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Art should be dangerous and like strange.
It seemed like such a good idea, right? You know what? We'll get these people in there. We'll take care of them for a couple years. It seems like a great idea.
Exactly.
No, it's not. It's not a good idea.
Yeah.
It doesn't belong there. But
yeah. No, I think a lot about kind of where we are too. And I I guess for me, like I'm thinking of poetry in particular, a lot of poetry. I mean, again, you can acquire a taste for it. Like if you make the effort and you go to the poetry readings and you put in time, you can find stuff that you really like, but in general, it doesn't hit people in the gut the first time they read it. And so I think that's part of the problem. And I know that like the ancients they had a guitar while they were saying, in other words, they were musicians basically.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, somewhere between like Dryden and Wordsworth is there was this separation between rhythm, rhyme, music, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the words, and that separation got, you know, wider and wider with Walt Whitman and T.S. Eliot. And eventually, like, there's no relation anymore between like the sound and sort of, I don't know what to call it, like the oral.
It's probably the printed word is probably
that's a good point.
Just the print.
I've thought it's like a psyop, you know, level. Because it is demoralizing. Because like, if you've ever heard those guys sing like, what are those Irish sea ballads called? The shanties or whatever.
Those are
enlivening because hear them, and even if you don't know the words, pretty soon you can sing the chorus, and it's fun. You know, I kind of wish that somehow we could get poetry to go back in that direction.
I tell you what, I've been reading
Protestantism.
Right. Yeah.
I've been reading through Yeats, not all at once, but like every day I read three. I have like the whole, all of Yeats. Right.
Yeah.
And it took me a while it's chronological. And the first stuff, like, I was like, there was a couple at the beginning. I was like, these are great. And then I was really kind of like, I don't understand what this is about. And then I realized what you're saying, like, these are actually songs. I'm trying to read a song,
right?
Like it's a paragraph from a book.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then what I've started to do, and not that I know what the tune is, but I tried to like find some kind of crude tune that fits it. And then actually sing it. Like I will sing it aloud. Again, I'm not recreating what Yeats did because I don't know what the notation is at all. Just something that kind of fits, and immediately it's five times more of an experience to read that.
I mean, I think this could be Protestantism, like Kevin says, you know, or the printing press. But it could also be like, I do think it's also related to that sort of devastation of like, you know, kind of modernism, like World War One, electricity, the, you know, railroad, all those kinds of things that, like, I used to give this example where when I was teaching, talking about, like, Thoreau would talk about how, well, forget Thoreau, but to give you the example, like, if you think of the way that the sun comes up at, you know, I don't know, 5:30 a.m. in the summer, but not until 8:30 in the winter. Mm-hmm. So, like, it kind of does a cosine wave through the year, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, what most all of us do now is just set our alarm for 7:03 all year. And so we're like, nature moves in these like rhythms and sort of pulsations, whereas we've mechanized ourselves and are no longer even in touch with it.
Yeah.
Which is like a real, that's like that again, that like might have some consequences, you know, long term.
And you imagine you do what seems like a choice for efficiency over and over and over and over and over again. And then suddenly, you know, you're optimizing everything. you're cutting off everything that doesn't fit, and eventually you're like, oh, well,
and so like, of course the music is dropped, right? Because like music was the vibration it took to walk through a forest and hunt a deer, and you know, or whatever. I don't even, these are things that are like, you know,
they're so removed we can barely talk about them. No, that's really interesting. Well, I appreciate you sharing some poets with, and honestly, you said Bridget Pajean Kelly, and like the best poetry reading I've ever heard was her.
You heard her, huh?
That's awesome. My God. She changed my life. And I'm not, I didn't have her for poetry. I had her for a class called Poetics of the Novel, and every book she recommended was just incredible.
And, let's go.
And had some conversations with her that were just profound, and oh my God, for people who are listening to this, read a poem called and read it aloud, you know, go into a closet or something, read it aloud. There's a poem called All Wild Animals Were Once Called Deer, Oh, it's so good.
It's awesome. Yeah, I have one on my channel if people can find it. Call it's called Song. I'm not sure what I titled the episode, but it's the one about the goat head that they cut off.
And,
And like you said, just like I basically just did that episode for me so I could read it out loud, you know? It's like
So there hopefully there are some people out there, and you know, I guess I did bag on art being in academia, but if it wasn't for academia, I wouldn't have had a chance to meet her and some other people too. So
yeah, and like I had a couple, I shouldn't say like I I'll just say like I left academia more or less, but I had a sometimes good experience, and I met some nice, like some not nice, but like people who seemed serious along the way. I remember there was a guy at some of those Melville conferences I would go to named Dan Beachy Quick, who writes poetry, and
I know that name. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's still publishing, and he wrote at least one book of poems based on Moby Dick, which of course, like, you know, hit me in the heart. But
yeah, he's from Kenyon, isn't he? Or not?
Anyway. I don't know what college he's even at. That could be. But anyway, so like, yeah, there are good people. I don't mean to just like trash.
Yeah, it's not a
It's just the institution has this kind of like stupid direction.
Well, that's all these things. All these things have taken on a life of their own, and you want to point a finger, but there's nobody to point it at. It's like we all kind of did it together, and it's not just that. It's not just like, you know, the academy. It's your fucking bank. It's like it's everything, right? It's, you know, it's Amazon, it's everybody. And this is what's Kafkaesque about it. There's like nowhere to friggin' turn.
I mean, this is like why
I just want a way out.
I read almost impulsively and defensively against all that. Because it's like, you know, you go well, like, you know, like Plutarch, I know for a fact Plutarch existed before Bank of America. And so I'm going to go try to figure out like what he, you know, and you know, it's not always reliable.